From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Columbia Gas's incoming president talks about leading the company after the explosions in the Merrimack Valley.
We have been here for 150 years. We will be here for the future. We will be able to regain the trust of all of our customers, the elected officials, and the communities. And that's really my goal.
Also today, a new book makes the case that animals have feelings too.
I think all the emotions that we have, disgust and guilt and shame and pride and hope and all these things, one way or another, you can find in other species.
And the strategy behind current Jeopardy contestant James Holzhauer's record-breaking winning streak.
There's not a lot of professional gamblers out there. Even if people wanted to be, I don't think a lot of them have the mindset that, oh, I can just put in $10,000 and if I lose, okay.
All that next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Columbia Gas of Massachusetts is getting new leadership. The utility's pipeline started more than 100 fires and explosions in the Merrimack Valley last fall, killing one person and injuring two dozen more. The preliminary findings of a federal investigation show the faulty pipework of one of their engineers caused their lines to overpressurize. The company has since replaced hundreds of miles of affected pipes and paid millions of dollars in claims in an effort to restore the damage. Against that backdrop, Columbia Gas of Massachusetts President Steve Bryant in February announced he'd be retiring. Mark Kempick, the company's chief operating officer, will officially take over as Columbia Gas's president tomorrow. When we spoke earlier today, Kempick outlined his vision for the company.
I have been up working here locally in Massachusetts since the end of September. I've previously been with various subsidiaries of Columbia Gas since literally 1979. But I came up here in September to help out with the recovery and the restoration. On a going forward basis, our number one goal is to work with our customers, work with the communities to regain that trust in our service, in our employees, in the provision of our service safely and reliably to the communities all throughout Massachusetts. So my goal and my team's goal is to work with our communities to rebuild that trust.
So winter is over. On the ground there in the Merrimack Valley, what efforts are currently underway?
Sure. Thank you for that. In fact, you'll probably be seeing a lot of our vehicles on the road and the vehicles of our contractors as we work towards restoring the private property soft surfaces. What we mean by soft surfaces is the grass, sometimes retaining walls, all those elements on a customer's properties that had to be disturbed last fall to put in the brand new pipelines and the safety features to provide them with gas service. So we repaired it slightly last fall. We put in some grass seed, but we're doing the really final job now by reseeding, regrading, putting more topsoil on, maybe even putting plants in, maybe even fixing some concrete driveways or some retaining walls. And we're in the middle of doing all of that right now. In addition, we have kicked off our heating equipment replacement program. So you'll see a lot of contractors out there putting in some heating equipment for our customers. As you might recall, last fall we were up against the cold weather coming in, so we decided to safely repair a number of heating units, about 900 heating units last fall, and then we made a commitment at that time to go back and replace those heating units with brand new high-efficiency heating units. So we're in the process of doing that right now, so we will be calling our customers and scheduling appointments so that we will come in and advise them of their options in terms of heating equipment replacement units, and then coming back and scheduling at their convenience when we can put that heating unit into their home.
Are you confident that you'll be able to complete that before next winter?
Yes, we've already made a lot of progress. Every day we're calling more and more customers. We have all summer long to do this, and we have really put the team in full gear over the past couple of weeks. So they are out in full force in all three of our communities replacing those remaining heating units. So we are very confident that we will get that done.
Okay. So according to the company, about 97% of registered claims have been paid out for a total of about $100 million. Financial reports indicate the disaster has cost Columbia Gas more than $1 billion. How does the company plan to cover those costs?
Sure. Thank you for that question. And one of the benefits of being part of a larger organization is that we had the financial wherewithal, as well as the employees from six other states, to come up and help us with the recovery effort. We have insurance to cover a lot of these costs, and so we are reaching out to the insurers or working with the insurers now to cover a lot of these costs so that the customers don't have to be worried about those costs.
And can the customers expect a rate hike to help cover those costs?
Right now, our goal is restoring everything with our customers and going to the insurers first. Until we go to the insurers, we're not even thinking about going to the customers for any type of rate recovery. But our goal is, number one, to get everybody back in these heating units replaced this year and get all the restoration done, then work at the same time with the insurance companies for recovery. And that's really our focus for this summer.
So can you rule out a rate cut, in 2019 or through 2020?
It's just, frankly, too early. We haven't gone down that path to determine any type of rate recovery. We don't know until we go to the insurers, which is our first line of investigation. And we're working with those insurers right now on all of these costs. To add to that, I would add that many of the costs that we've invested in we'd never ask the customers to pay for those costs, such as the cost of the appliances and a lot of the other costs with the housing that we provided to customers. Those are just things that are not recovered from the customers of a regulated utility. So there's no fear that we'd be going to ask customers for the majority of those costs.
Okay, I want to talk about the claims processing. Lawrence Mayor Dan Rivera has been publicly critical about that process, saying that it is too slow and accusing Columbia Gas of grinding your feet. Also, Congressman Seth Moulton told me that Columbia Gas has been out to lunch since the explosions. Is that claims process too slow?
I would say no. I mean, like any process, it's a required process. We do ask for documentation to ensure that everybody is being treated fairly. And we have worked successfully through over 23,000 claims. Each one of those claims is different. And we have claims adjusters who get to know the customer and who work with the customer to identify their specific needs and to address those specific needs. Now, sometimes we get into very difficult claims, and we've actually had to hire forensic accountants to help the customer put their claim together because they might not have had the paperwork in existence to demonstrate what they needed to do to give to us to be able to compensate them appropriately. Mm-hmm. So that takes some time when we hire the forensic accountant and provide it to the customer. And that's really what we've been working through. But overall, at this 6.5 month time period, processing over 97% of the claims and paying out well over $100 million, I'm actually very, very proud of our team and the work that they have done.
On the federal level in Washington, Senator Ed Markey and Senator Elizabeth Warren, along with Congresswoman Lori Trahan, are introducing legislation to boost penalties for safety violations, require on-site pressure monitoring during construction, and mandate professional engineers to oversee pipeline projects. Do you back that legislation?
So we have already done many of the things identified in the legislation, and we will continue to do those. One of the key elements of the legislation is what they call a safety management system, and we are really leading the state and leading, frankly, the industry in our adoption of the safety management system. We have adopted that even prior to last year, and we will continue to move forward with the safety management system, which is really, frankly, the best way of perpetuating a good safety culture and making sure that all of our companies can provide a safe and reliable service that the customers deserve.
So does that mean you support the legislation, or you think it's unnecessary because of the steps you're taking?
You know, it's hard to really get into a line-by-line element of the legislation. I know that there's a lot of comments being done by various members of the industry, and we are in the process of working with the parties to that legislation. So, as I said, there are a lot of elements that we fully support, and we're working with the principals on some changes to other parts of the legislation. So a lot more work has to be done, but we are fully engaged in the conversation, and we are fully supportive of the notion of moving a safety management system forward, as well as moving a lot of the provisions of that legislation forward.
Okay. I want to talk about 2 weeks ago, Columbia Gas notified Monson Police of a possible overpressurization of gas lines. Do you think that was handled well?
Yes, that element is still, frankly, under investigation, so we can't go into a lot of the reasons for the cause of that because it's still a confidential investigation. However, the system worked as designed and prevented any impact to customers downstream. So it was a much, much different situation than what happened in Lawrence. We had a lot of safety measures installed in that system, such as individualized pressure regulation at each customer's homes, as well as a newer system that was tested for higher pressures, and it did operate, frankly, a normal operating pressure at a higher pressure. So safety systems that were built into that relatively new system weren't built into some of our other systems because they were older systems. And so one of our goals across the state is to continue to advance the replacement of our aging infrastructure so that everyone across the entire state has new high-density polyethylene plastic pipe, as well as individualized safety regulators at their front door, as well as what we call excess flow valves to prevent against the release of gas if somebody were to unfortunately dig into their service line. So that's our goal, is to continue to move forward to the future and to put in the state-of-the-art new gas distribution system throughout the remainder of Massachusetts.
And in the short time we have left, you started talking about regaining the trust of the residents of the Merrimack Valley. I know WBUR, an information request, turned up five other times since 2011 that there had been reported pressure spikes. As I said, I spoke with Congressman Seth Moulton. He said that he believes that Columbia Gas should be shut down, that it can't regain the trust of the residents. What do you say to him and the folks living in that region right now?
So my focus is really looking forward and engaging with the communities, engaging with our elected officials, and demonstrating that we have been here for 150 years. We will be here for the future. We will be able to regain the trust of all of our customers, the elected officials, and the communities. And that's really my goal, is to prove that we can and we will, and we have been continuing to provide that safe and reliable service.
That's Mark Kempick, incoming president and chief operating officer for Columbia Gas of Massachusetts. Mark, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Kimberly. I appreciate your interest in Columbia Gas. Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up, a new book makes the case that animals experience emotions just like humans do. I'm Kimberly Atkins. This is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Do you have a better sense of humor than a chimpanzee? Are you more sensitive than a bonobo? At the heart of these questions lies an evolutionary and biological mystery. Do animals have the same emotions as humans? And if they do they experience them the same way we do? In a new book, biologist Franz Duval examines the social, cultural, and emotional lives of primates, dogs, elephants, even fish, to challenge the idea that humans are emotionally unique. In fact, he says, we may not be the only species that experiences love, shame, fear, guilt, joy, disgust, and empathy, all of which have long been thought of as uniquely human. Duval has studied the social behaviors of primates for the last four decades. His new book is called Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. And he joins me now. Franz, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. I'm glad to be there.
Listeners, we also want you to join the conversation. Do you think animals experience emotions similar to humans? How do you emotionally connect with animals, maybe a pet or an animal you've encountered elsewhere? You can call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. And Franz, I want to first talk about your book as a really comprehensive look at the emotions that animals experience. But before that, I want you to explain the difference between feelings and emotions.
Okay. Emotions are manifested in the body. So it's very hard to be highly emotional and not have higher blood pressure or higher heart rate or change your voice. Actually, if you call someone, you can hear from the voice and what mood they are. That's the body that's reflected there. Facial expressions, of course, all sorts of things. Feelings are when you become aware of your emotions. And so not all emotions reach that stage of consciousness where you become aware of them and can talk about them. So feelings, I communicate with language. I tell you what I feel and why I feel it and stuff like that. But emotions, you don't need me to explain it. You can see it in my face.
So it's harder to know whether animals experience feelings the way we do. But are there ways to measure whether they exhibit that emotional response that you're talking
about?
Yeah,
the emotions in terms of the body are very similar to ours. In the primates, certainly the facial expressions are very similar to ours and the whole body is similar. But, you know, a rat who is afraid, you give the rat some odor of a cat and they become fearful, they will have cold feet, cold tail. And we also, we humans, we have cold feet when we get fearful. So you withdraw blood from the extremities of your body. And amygdala is activated in the rat when that happens. Amygdala is activated in humans. So basically our fear is very similar to a rat's fear in terms of how it is manifested in the body.
Now, I have an excerpt from the book that I'd love for you to read, if you don't mind. I want to talk about the way you observe the emotions that drive behavior and maybe even hint at feelings, even if we can't measure those. Mm-hmm. So this is a passage about a chimp named Amos, if you would.
Yeah, that's a male chimp at Yerkes Field Station. One day, Amos, former alpha male Amos, was panting at a rate of 60 breaths per minute. Sweat poured from his face. We hadn't recognized his poor condition earlier because, like most males, he had hidden it for a long time, as long as he could. Males avoid showing vulnerabilities. Only after his death, a few days later, did we learn that Amos had an enlarged liver. He had an enlarged liver and multiple cancers. Since he refused to go outdoors with the rest, we kept him apart and cracked open the door to his night cage. A female friend named Daisy regularly came to visit. She reached through the crack to tenderly groom behind his ears. At some point, she fetched wood, wool, and started pushing large amounts of it towards Amos. Chimps like to build nests with such material. Daisy reached in several times to stuff the wood, wool behind Amos's back, between his back and the wall against which he was leaning, as if she realized he was in pain and would be better off leaning against something soft. It looked like the way we arrange pillows behind a patient in the hospital.
Wow, wow. What does that tell you about the relationship that primates have with each other and how those relationships are similar that we have to what we have as humans?
Well, it shows that Daisy was very caring, but also that she had some sort of idea of what would be comfortable for him, which is really interesting. They take the perspective of somebody else. And so the empathy responses, we do a lot of studies of that. Empathy is very highly developed, I think, in all the mammals. But in chimps and some other, like dolphins and elephants, you get in addition that they also can imagine the situation to some degree of somebody else.
I want to talk about the titular chimp in this book, Mama. Mm-hmm. And I have some tape here of Mama from April 2016 when she's at the Royal Burger Zoo in the Netherlands. And in this video, she's 59 years old, clearly nearing her end. And biologist Jan van Hoof comes and sees her. And this chimp that he's known since 1972. So as you'll hear, he calls to her, and after a little rousing, she recognizes her old friend.
Mama.
Ja, vrouwtje. Ja, ja.
So for those of you who haven't seen this, and you can find the video on our website, radioboston.org, Mama reaches out and hugs Jan, grinning with just her gums because she's lost all her teeth. And she's patting and stroking his head while he coos back at her. It's really beautiful and heartbreaking. So will you tell us about Mama and what made you choose her as the main character of this book? What does she represent?
So Mama was the alpha female of a very large colony in a zoo in the Netherlands. And she was alpha female for 40 years. So she was extremely central figure. And I named her, actually, Mama, because she was sort of the mother of the group. And even though she was not physically dominant over the males, which in chimps almost never happens, but she was very powerful. She was really the core of the group, and everyone would come to her if there was a crisis. And she had also very good relationships with humans. She maintained the diplomatic relationships with the humans, including Jan van Hoven. That's why he had a connection with her, and he went to see her on her deathbed. And we normally never go in with an adult chimpanzee, especially Mama, for example, very strong female. So you never go in with an adult chimp. But in this case, she was very weakened, and so Jan decided to go. And what you see in the movie, actually, is that she is calming him down. Instead of him calming her down, she must have sensed that he was nervous a bit of getting in there, and so she tapped him on the back the way a chimp female would do with a youngster who's upset.
I want to get to some of our callers. Joan is calling from West Yarmouth. Hi there, Joan. Joan, are you there? All right, we're going to move on to Ray. He's calling in from Danvers. Hi there, Ray.
Hi, how are you? I just wanted to say, you know, people are obviously emotional. People have feelings, and animals relate directly to people because pets, animals relate not through, obviously, voice commands or anything else. It's emotional feelings. Dogs, they feel regret, they happiness, joy, they have fear. You can see it in their eyes. You can see it in most mammals. I can't say much about fish, but the only way people relate to animals is through emotion. And I think it's very obvious.
Yeah, so that's through body language we relate to them, and they relate to our body language. Actually, animals are excellent at reading our body language and hearing our voice and so on. Well, I think a lot of people think this, but in science, for the longest time, there was a taboo on talking about emotions. And so the psychologists, the behaviorists, we call them, they told us never to talk about emotions. And I was taught as a student not to use the word at all. And so if, for example, chimpanzees kiss, I would have to call it mouth-to-mouth contact, or if they reconcile, I would have to call it post-conflict contact, or if you tickle a baby chimp and it laughs, because they do that, they have very laugh-like sounds, you have to call it vocalized panting. So they wanted us to stay away from the connection with human behavior, and as a result, for the longest time, we didn't talk about these things.
And I want to remind our callers, you can reach us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-423-TALK. Do you think animals experience emotions similar to humans? How do you emotionally connect with them? We want to hear from you. So, Franz, I want to point out that when you're looking at the emotions of animals, it's not always rosy and about peace and cooperation. In the book, you describe that while primates have empathy and positive emotions, they also do things like commit murder or maim each other, especially when it comes to the power structure. You provide the example of Lewitt, am I saying that correctly?
Yeah, yeah.
Lewitt, who would be an alpha male at this chimp colony at the zoo, but after rising to power, two other males whose power he had usurped came back and really attacked him quite violently. What does this tell us about the complicated power structures and social lives of primates?
Yeah, the chimpanzees are always balancing between these things. They're balancing between being enemies and being ready to kill somebody, which they sometimes do, And being friends, because the males can also be friends and help each other and groom with each other and play with each other and things like that. And so they have this tension between positive and negative emotions always going on. And in the chimpanzee colony, the females usually don't have as intense a competition going on between themselves. And so they have more time for caring relationships than the males. But the males always looking over their shoulder.
Anya is calling from Somerville. Hi there, Anya.
Hi. So it's a fascinating topic. I just wanted to say that, of course, I can see in my cats, I have cats, they are pure emotions. And the way they read us humans is incredible. They fear and they, I would say, friendship and sense of pleasure. But I wanted to say or ask about other things. It's scary to me to think what animals go through from humans, how cruel humans can be to animals, and how cruelty to animals was so horrid in the past, and now it's maybe a little better, but it's still horrible.
Yeah.
And if I think about all these emotions in slaughtering houses, I mean, this is absolutely, I can't even go there, because if you say, as a scientist, that they feel fear, they expect that something happens, that will happen, that they experience love, attachment, kindness, loneliness. Jesus, we're thinking about it. Oh my God! If those slaughtering houses had walls made of glass. And
yeah, no, that's that's exactly the point I make in the book, is because I talk about agricultural practices which are not as well regulated as we would want them to be, and that we need transparency. I think the ideal would be if we know what's going on. For example, if you buy a piece of meat, that you know how that animal was treated and you see pictures or videos of it, so that because they keep all this information from us. And it's actually not just the agricultural animals, even though I think that's definitely an enormous number that is there, but pets also. There's so many abandoned pets. People have a dog and then a year later they put the dog in a forest, which is also terrible. They do these things.
And on that topic, I think this sort of feeling about the treatment of animals might lead people to want to be vegetarians. They think that we shouldn't eat meat at all. Are you a vegetarian?
No,
what do you think about that?
I'm probably too much of a biologist to, because we see this the circle of life every day, basically. But I'm certainly worried about how we treat animals. I think these two things don't exclude each other. You can care about animals. And the way we now treat all these agricultural animals, which are billions and billions of cows and pigs and chickens, is really wrong, and it's not well regulated. Some of the states in this country barely regulate anything at all.
Now, you talk about anthropomorphism in your book. I know I am guilty of this with my terrier.
Okay.
I treat him very much as if he is human. But you say that it's not nearly as bad as people think, despite the fact that, you know, some folks warn against anthropomorphizing animals. You say that the rejection of similarity between humans and other animals is a greater problem than the assumption of it. But others say that doing that sells animals short. So will you explain why you think seeing our differences, the differences between humans and animals, is a greater problem than seeing the similarities?
Well, especially in relation to the primates. I'm a primatologist. And so if you talk about chimpanzees, which are so similar to us, I think in order to understand a chimpanzee, you need to use human terminology and to assume a human-like psychology. So if the example again that I gave, if you tickle a chimpanzee baby and it has this laugh expression and laughing sounds, you have to call it laughing and not some other term, because you have to respect the relationship, the evolutionary relationship that exists between us and the chimpanzee. Now, that doesn't mean that if you interpret the behavior of an octopus or a fish, that you can use a lot of human concepts there. I'm not sure that that's possible. But with animals close to us, I think it's a bigger problem to deny the similarities than to assume them.
We have Avril calling in from Woonsocket, Rhode Island. Hi, Avril.
Hi there. How anybody could deny that animals have emotions and truly experience emotions just sort of boggles my mind. I was a veterinary nurse for 16 years, and I have handled so many animals and lived with so many animals. About 9 years ago, my mother passed away from ovarian cancer, and prior to her getting sick, she had a French bulldog puppy that she loved so much, and this dog was her whole world. And when my mother died, I watched that dog grieve. Mm-hmm. I mean, truly grieve.
Yeah, sure.
So much so that her behavior was never the same. The dog went from being a friendly, outgoing, happy puppy, and then afterwards, she became frightened and dog aggressive. And just never the same. Never the same.
Yeah, so grieving is a result of attachment. The grieving occurs when individuals are attached to each other and love each other. And of course, attachment is in all the mammals you find it. And so, for example, a dog is one example, a dog and a human. But you also have, for example, partners of, let's say, birds who are mated and one partner dies. I've had that happen in my birds that I had. And then the other bird also dies a couple of weeks later. So these things happen. And in the wild, we see situations where, for example, a mother chimpanzee or a mother orca loses an offspring. And there was recently, like last year, there was an orca who carried her calf around for 17 days, a dead calf, even though it had died. And the scientists were very worried that she was losing weight and that she was going to be starving because she was not eating all that time. But apparently the other orcas were feeding her in the meantime. And so, yeah, you have these grieving processes and depressions, and you can actually measure them. You can measure the cortisol levels, which is a stress hormone, and they go up in individuals like that. So it is very similar to human depressions, I think.
Last week on Radio Boston, we talked about a case in Connecticut where an appeals court was hearing arguments in a case about the rights of elephants. It was basically an animal rights group claiming that elephants at a petting zoo that were being held in awful conditions had something akin to personhood. Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. I know that's not what you consider in your book, but what does what your research shows tell us about the rights of animals? Should we think differently about the rights that we bestow to animals?
Yeah, I'm not a lawyer. I usually don't think in terms of rights and personhood and that kind of terminology. But we certainly have an obligation. We have an obligation to animals, especially animals in our care. We have an obligation to treat them well. And so if elephants are kept in substandard conditions, yeah, we have to worry about that.
All right. Amy is calling from Charlestown. Hi there.
Hi there. How are you?
I'm good.
Good. I have a trained therapy dog who works at Spalding, primarily in traumatic brain injury. Harry the Healer is what the staff call him because he is so riveting when it comes to people who basically have not a lot of contact with anybody or anything. And Harry's a bed dog there. He is next to them. He does not move, and he hugs with his eyes. It is breathtaking.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
and it is so clear to all of us the impact that this dog has with people. Some of their first words are Harry.
Oh, that's amazing. Thank you, Amy, for that call. Go ahead, Franz.
Yeah, there was a cat named Oscar, I believe, who could feel when people were dying. And so he, in a certain hospital, that cat would go to the bed of someone who was going to die that same night and would sleep with them. And so there's a whole story on Oscar the cat and how sensitive he was to the state in which people were. And he would bring comfort to them and sit on them. Yeah.
John's calling from Brookline. Hi there, John.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Go ahead.
Thanks. So I was thinking about how memory is sort of one of the sort of abstract types of thought that humans are. You know, we sort of differentiate animals from humans because of our ability to think abstractly. And then I watch a show where a chimpanzee hasn't seen their human friend for years and years and years and comes and hugs them, gives them this massive hug as if they've been missing them.
Yeah.
It's very different from a greeting after not having seen someone for, you know, a day. And so I wonder, you know, you're talking about attachment and among the species, but what is memory like for animals as an emotional tool?
Thanks, John. Yeah. That's just like Mama in that video.
Oh, they have excellent memories. Let me tell you one story. There was a female chimp named Lolita, who I knew at the primate center where I worked. And 30 years later, she had moved to a different place. I think it was in Texas. She had moved to a totally different place. And 30 years later, I visited that place. And they said, well, we have that female Lolita here. Do you still remember her? And so I walked up to her area. And I had a face mask on, so she didn't recognize me. But then I started talking to her, and immediately she came forward. She immediately recognized me. This is after 30 years of not seeing me, which was pretty incredible. So the memory of relationships, if you have an established relationship, are very long and very well developed. And we also have evidence, because in my book I talk not about just about emotions related to the past, but also about the future, like hope and expectation. And we also know that animals can think ahead. And so all these time-related emotions, so to speak, gratitude, or which is for the past, or forgiveness for the past, and hope is for the future, all these time-related emotions exist also.
So what is it that makes human emotions different from animals? I mean, I know we have different social constructs that we're dealing with. Animals may not deal with things like economic disparities or race or political differences.
Economic disparities. We do experiments, actually, on inequality between monkeys.
And, oh, really?
If you feed monkeys for a task different foods, where one, let's say one of them gets grapes and the other one gets cucumber, and grapes are 10 times better, the one who gets cucumber gets very upset.
Huh.
And so we do these inequality experiments. And so even that one you can find. And I would say there are no human emotions. This is pretty radical to say that. But there are no human emotions that we don't find one way or another in animals. All human emotions, we may be a bit more sophisticated in certain areas or apply them more broadly, but all emotions can be found in other species.
I'm going to try to get another call in. Chase from South Boston. Hi there.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm good.
So, yeah, I just wanted to talk about, just real quick, a little story that I had seen. It was about, I think it was a German Shepherd or something like that, that he basically jumped out his second-story window almost every morning to follow his owner. And they didn't know what was going on, and they kind of saw the same as a mood depressive disorder. They actually treated it with the same prescription drugs like that any, you know, one of you or I would have. And I just thought it was super interesting that the brain is, you know, as far off as a dog might be, it's pretty closer to us.
Oh, yeah, but
really
it goes much further. There's now experiments on depression in fish. So what they do in zebra fish, which they use in many labs, is they made the zebra fish dependent on alcohol by giving them ethanol in the water on occasion. And then at some point they withdrew it, and so they created the depression. And then they could treat the depression with some antidepressive drug that we also use for humans, and the fish became normal again. So these mechanisms in the brain are extremely ancient that we share with an enormous amount of species, not just with your dog, but even with fish.
In just a few seconds we have left, what would you like to see us learn from primates?
Well, I think the thing to learn is that there is continuity, that we try to set ourselves always apart, like what makes us different. We are so special. I don't think we're that special. And so my point is that even in the emotional domain, there's all these connections.
That's primatologist Frans de Waal. His new book is Mama's Last Hug, Animal Emotions and What They Tell Us About Ourselves. Frans, thanks so much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And you can see Frans de Waal talk about his new book tonight at 6:30 at WBUR's City Space. A link on that and more is on our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, we'll talk Jeopardy and the strategy behind current contestant James Holzhauer behind his winning streak. I'm Kimberly Atkins, and this is Radio Boston.
Wait a second.
Don't hit the skip button.
I mean, we know you do it.
We just wanted to take a second here because you already know how to download a podcast.
But you might have a question about some of the other technology you use, and we think we can help.
WBUR is working on a new show, and we're here to answer your tech questions, whether it's hardware-related,
software-related, social, even ethical.
Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and give us a call. Leave a message, 617-917-4717.
Give it a try, 617-917-4717.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Finally today, we're going to talk about Jeopardy and the show's latest sensation, James Holzhauer. Here's host Alex Trebek introducing him on the show last week.
Unless you've been living under a rock for the past 2 weeks, you know about our current champion, James. Now, it is worth noting that when Ken Jennings had his amazing run of 74 wins in a row, he was averaging $34,000 per victory. James is averaging $71,000 per victory. Enough said.
James Holzhauer is the professional sports gambler who is not afraid to bet big. And in a close game last night where he won by just $18, he brought his winning streak to 18 games. That means his total winnings is over $1,329,000. He's also won 8 of the 10 richest games in the show's history. So what exactly is Holzhauer doing differently, and how has he changed the game? Joining me now from Chicago is Benjamin Soldhoff. He's a lecturer in computational social science at the University of Chicago. Hello.
Hi.
And also with us from New York City is a previous Jeopardy winner who represented Boston when he was on the show, Dan Pawson. He's also one of the top 10 highest earners on the show ever. Hello, Dan.
Hi, nice to be here.
Thank you both for joining us. I want to start with Benjamin. What do you make of James' winning streak thus far? Have you seen anything like this before?
I mean, we've seen champions in the past that have been able to win successfully and cure these kinds of long winning streaks. Not very many, but there have been some. What's really been interesting, I think, with him is just the sheer size of his victories every game. He's had pretty much almost every competition was a lock. It was going into Final Jeopardy, and he's winning a very large money, as Alex Trebek mentioned before. It's that he's just has such a very large earnings on a daily average.
And Dan, your lifetime winnings from the show are over $420,000. That's a lot. $250,000 of that was from the 2009 Tournament of Champions, and that's combined with a 9-day winning streak on the show that earned you over $170,000. Wow. You're one of the top 10 highest winners on the show ever. But James has outpaced you, and even Jeopardy legend Ken Jennings. What's your reaction to how he's doing?
Yeah, I mean, records are made to be broken. James, it's funny to hear. Right, hear you talk about what I made, which is a decent week for James, and sometimes even less than that. It's, you know, you can be a great champion on Jeopardy by being really quick with the buzzer and just beating everyone to clues everyone knows, or you can know the really esoteric things that are at the bottom of the board. And James, you know, the very best champions do both, and James does both about as well and maybe better than anybody who's ever done it. And then it helps also to be absolutely fearless when it comes to betting.
Now, James Holzhauer talked about the buzzer. This is him speaking with SportsCenter about what he identified as one big part of why he's winning.
I think the buzzer skill, you know, I practiced buzzing at home, but obviously, on the stage is a completely different animal, and I think I'm just kind of lucky in a way that the buzzer technique I practiced turned out to be such a successful one. But I read an ebook called Secrets of the Buzzer, go check Amazon, that had a lot of helpful advice in that regard, so maybe it wasn't all luck.
And so, Benjamin, how much of it is tactical skill like that, knowing how to use the Jeopardy buzzer versus memory or intellect?
I think a substantial amount. I mean, most competitors on Jeopardy, they go through the process of applying to getting tested to go on the show. They're all very intelligent individuals. And so for most questions on the board, I would bet, I mean, again, most of the competitors are going to know the answers. Having those quick reaction times, be able to ring in before the other individuals on stage, that's going to be really crucial. And it's something that James has been able to achieve a good deal of success with so far.
So, Benjamin, you also talk about a skill that James has been utilizing, a technique called the forest bounce. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, so the traditional Jeopardy contestant Kind of the way I think a lot of people expect them to play at home is that you kind of go across the board from top to bottom. You start with the clues at the higher end of the board, the lower dollar value clues, and work your way down. It's kind of how the clue writers on the show expect contestants to participate, because they're writing them in a way that they get incrementally more difficult as you go down. But what James and some previous champions have done before him is, instead of following this kind of top-down format, is bouncing around the board. So kind of randomly selecting between categories, going for the higher dollar value clues immediately to try and have the chance to ring in and get that money right away.
And Dan, what techniques did you use when you were on the show? Does any of this sound familiar, or do you think people are taking different approaches now?
Yeah, no, I think this sounds kind of familiar in a lot of the best champions, especially when they're against other really, really good players, will try to get those daily doubles to get them off the board. I definitely did in my tournament of champions and avoid picking sort of the top row clues that never have those daily doubles in them. What James does that is, I think, different is always go for the high-value clues right at the beginning of each of them. And so he's got more money in his pocket when he hits the daily doubles, because that bottom row is worth almost as much as the top three rows combined. Mm-hmm. And he's less likely to lose control of the board, because if he doesn't know a clue, it's one of the bottom really hard ones, and as opposed to one of the top couple of rows where most people know most of the answers.
Any other tips that you utilize? Is it certain categories that you would try to go to or stay away from, or any other tactical tricks?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's this sort of core group of topics that Jeopardy always touches, the, you know, world capitals and Shakespeare and opera and U.S. presidents and those. And then there are sort of concentric circles around them about lakes and rivers or vice presidents, first ladies, things that are a little bit less likely to come up but still do from time to time. And James just seems to be six or seven circles out, where he's just he's studied sort of everything. And when when you have a lot of confidence in a category, if they're going to ask you something about world capitals and you know every single world capital, you're going to bet all of your money or a huge amount of your money. James has that confidence, and he's made it work for him.
So Benjamin, 538, wrote of James's success. They write, "Perhaps Holtower's success is the natural evolutionary destination of the show, a final full realization of the strategic potential locked within its own giant board." Benjamin, is Jeopardy just all about strategy at this point?
To a certain extent. I think it's certainly the knowledge still matters, having that information. Another player in trying to adopt James's strategy right now would not be as successful if they can't back that up with knowing the answers for the clues. It's really that combination of knowledge and strategy that's really led James to success. I think if you see other competitors attempting to adopt the strategy, I think we saw a little bit of an example of that yesterday with Adam willing to take such a large gamble on some of the daily doubles, the ones that he was able to find. It kept the match very close. And so there, if he had been going up against any other competitor that day, he probably would have won and won a substantial amount of money. But it just was pure luck going up against James that was only second best.
Yeah, and the competitor he beat by that slim margin was also from Massachusetts. I want to play another clip from James Holzhauer speaking with SportsCenter about his background as a professional gambler is helping him.
There's not a lot of professional gamblers out there. Even if people wanted to be, I don't think a lot of them have the mindset that, oh, I can just put in $10,000 and if I lose, okay, you know, I'll move on with my game and keep playing the rest of the game with a level head. You know, there was a game last week where I bet $8,400, lost it all. And when I had $7,200 on the next daily double, I knew it was the right play to go all in again, so I just did it. No, not everyone's going to be able to come in with that game plan, and fewer still will be able to execute it.
Benjamin, do you think that's true?
Absolutely. I think people in general are generally risk-averse. They're unwilling to make those large wagers, even though they have a pretty good chance of being successful. James's background in professional gambling, to be successful in that field, I mean, you've got to have a good deal of confidence. You've got to have nerves to be able to back that up and recognize it's not always going to be successful. I think most of the time he's been making these large wagers in the daily doubles, he gets them right. Sometimes he doesn't, and he's been fortunate enough so far, he's been able to recover from those failures, but that's probably going to be one of the things that trips him up at the end that finally leads him to losing, is just guessing wrong.
Yeah. Dan, when there is a success at this magnitude, ultimately people always question whether the game is broken. There was a Washington Post piece by one-time Jeopardy contestant Charles Lane, and he writes that Jeopardy has stopped being fun and that, quote, people seem not to care that Holzhauer's streak reflects the same grim, data-proven approach to competition that has spoiled, among other sports, baseball. Dan, what do you make of that? Has he LeBron'd Jeopardy?
Yeah, as a long-term baseball fan, that makes me extremely angry, but I don't think this is the time or the place to get into
I think basketball's a better example too, right?
And into that. Oh, yeah, and you have James Harden continually getting fouled and taking tons of three-point. Well, we can get into all that. I think, you know, the same people said the same thing about Ken Jennings when he was on his run, and now the ratings skyrocket whenever Ken is back. It's popular to when something new is introduced to feel nostalgia for the old ways of doing it. And this isn't obviously a shot at Charles. I think that James is introducing something new and exciting to the game and has just figured something out, but styles adjust. And so eventually James will lose, you know, even if he's 99% to win every single game, eventually he'll get a daily double he needs wrong or a final wrong. And we will look back with nostalgia at this incredible run where somebody brought something new to a game that's been around for 35 years.
All right. That's Dan Pawson, one of the top 10 highest earners on Jeopardy, who represented Boston when he was on the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And also thank you to Benjamin Saltoff. He's a lecturer in computational social science at the University of Chicago. Thank you.
Thanks.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Soterik, Paris Alston, Zoe Mitchell, Eve Zukoff, and Walter Wuthman. Tim Skog is our technical director, with engineering today by Max Liebman. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Kimberly Atkins. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Wait, don't go yet.
Because you already know how to download a podcast.
But if you have any other tech or life question, maybe we can help you. WBUR is working on a new show, and we need your tech questions.
Or maybe your parents' questions. Just click that little phone-shaped app on your cell phone and leave a message. 617-917-4717.
Yes, we know. How quaint. A phone call. But give it a try. 617-917-4717.